documentary movie Eye of the Storm, premiered at the Glasgow Film Festival. It tells the story of landscape artist James Morrison, who passed away in August of last year. His work hangs in the homes of J.K. Rowling, the royal family, as well as museums and private collections around the world. But in the twilight of his life, he faces his greatest challenge. His eyesight is fading fast, and he has one more major painting to complete. He agreed to let filmmaker Anthony Baxter follow him as he picked up the brushes again at the age of 85 after being sidelined by a series of operations. While doing so, and by using archive footage and animation, he reflects on an extraordinary artistic life.
I've got somewhere in the studio a drawing of Mickey Mouse. That was when I started to draw. My whole life has been mixed up with the art, with painting.
What I experience, what I'm doing, is something which is for me. It's my argument with myself.
I'll talk to Anthony about the making of the film in a moment, and I'll also talk to Guy Peplow from the Scottish Gallery about who James Morrison was. And I thought I'd explore one more thing. What's it like to be an artist with a sight loss? To answer that question, I'll talk to blind artist Fiona Powell, who was actually taught by James Morrison. But first, let's head to the Scottish Gallery in Edinburgh, where James Morrison had 25 solo exhibitions, the last of which is shown in Eye of the Storm. Guy Peplow told me who James Morrison was.
James Morrison was a landscape painter, and that's how he would describe himself. I think he'd include the word landscape, and that's significant. He was deeply engaged with the landscape, whether it was the landscape of his kind of original home in Glasgow and the city centre that disappeared, that he recorded, or when he moved up to the northeast of Scotland, to Catiline and then to Montrose. That was what always drove him, was looking at the landscape. He was deeply immersed in the history of landscape painting, but my goodness, he had something to add to it as well. He wasn't just content to be an historian. He was someone that wanted to push the envelope.
He lived here in Montrose.
Filmmaker and director of Eye of the Storm, Anthony Baxter.
And I was introduced to him after he'd written to me when he saw one of my earlier films, You've Been Trumped, about Donald Trump destroying a stretch of wilderness in Aberdeenshire to build a golf resort. He was very moved by that destruction of the landscape as a landscape painter, and he wrote me a very moving letter, actually. He was well known locally as a brilliant landscape painter, and of course he's well known elsewhere in Scotland and around the country and indeed the world for his landscape paintings, but he's not what I would call a celebrity artist, and he kept pretty much a low profile. He was a friend of my uncle Dennis's, Dennis Rice, who is a native of Montrose and a longtime friend of James's. They'd known each other for well over 30 years. So Dennis suggested I went up and had a coffee. So it was a real delight to meet him. And it was at that conversation, that meeting over a coffee, that I first broached the idea of possibly filming him. He had at that stage put down his paintbrushes for a while. He was getting very, very frustrated with the fact that he was losing his vision. And that was quite a traumatic thing, as you can imagine, for an artist to not be able to have that sense of distance, I think, was the main thing that first started.
Jim was someone who, like most painters, he had periods of terrible self-doubt. You could characterise as perhaps even as depression. And that was, with 20/20 vision. And clearly when something physically, something so basic to your world is disappearing in the way that it did latterly, it was a terrible thing for him. But at the same time, you know, the will to be an artist is so strong, and the resilience of the human spirit is so strong as well, particularly in someone like James Morrison. It wasn't an entirely negative thing. He knew that he would have to adapt. He'd have to work as he always had, through the issues that presented themselves so he could continue to be a painter.
So when he was painting in the studio, he just found it very difficult to get the technical ability and the range that he would have done. And that was really quite depressing for him. I said to him, well, if you decide to go back to painting, I would love to be able to follow you on film, potentially. And so I did some exploratory filming with him and then sent that footage to one of the commissioners at the BBC, and they commissioned the film. And that's how the film started. It started originally as a BBC production and then grew a bit with further support.
Age-related macular degeneration, which is what he had, it came on him slowly. Of course, he was under the doctor. He had consultations with very senior people in Scotland. He used lenses, and he fought hard to keep his vision as clear as he possibly could. Imagine that one of the most important things that a landscape painter can do is to go out into the landscape and look. And of course, Jim could work close too with magnification, with lenses, but what he could no longer do in the last few years of his life was actually get out and see, get that kind of visual stimulation from actually walking the landscape, being within the landscape, which had been so important to him. But he could continue to work. I've thought about this, and it's interesting with Morrison, his journey as a painter. Because when he started out, and you see some of those very early things painted in Glasgow and some of the best things he made up in Kincardineshire when he moved there in the late 50s, very broadly painted, broad brush marks, very freely painted, sort of almost like abstract expressionism, not kind of tight painting, which perhaps a lot of people associate with the kind of realism which almost our landscape sometimes demands. And then in the middle period, yes, there's lots of very, very fine drawing, very accurate recording of information. But at the same time, what perhaps appears on one level to be very, very detailed is in fact just suggestive. It's the art that conceals art. It's what the marks that he made that then suggested something more. And he was able to continue in that way as his sight went, so that these later works are very powerful, a lot of tonal contrast in them. His eyes are perhaps demand stronger colour. You can see strong colour in the late work of all sorts of artists, like Titian and Monet, that kind of broadly painted strong colour that perhaps with changing eyesight, the artist begins to use and deploy. That is in these late Morrison paintings. Very atmospheric, very powerful, quite broadly painted, in a way returned to some of the things he did in the earliest period.
Now, you mentioned his AMD, and we have simulators at RNIB that let you see what that condition is like through the eyes of someone who has it. And Dark Landscape kind of reminds me of one of those simulators. It's like part of the landscape is obscured. It's very detailed in places, but it's very hidden in others.
Yes. Yes, well, I think that's an interesting observation. Anything gradual is different from a kind of a sudden shift. And certainly for Jim, it was a gradual process, and in a way, one that he fought hard with, using, as I say, all the kind of means that he could to sort of keep his sight as sharp as possible for as long as possible. But in the end, yes, that kind of obscuring, kind of darker side, there it is in the work. And I think that's fascinating. And it doesn't make these works poorly made works of art. They are different. And I think an artist is always changing and developing. It's the next work that's always the important one. And certainly for Jim Morrison, I mean, the doubt was there, but also that will. And I think he would sometimes be very satisfied, even in the last couple of years of his life, when he was working with what he managed to produce in these very difficult circumstances, as you say, partially obscured by the illness that came upon him.
One of the things he had in the studio was, well, he had invested in various glasses to help. That was a kind of basic thing, I suppose, but that was part of the process of the frustration of losing his vision and trying various tools to help him get back to the vision that he had. But of course, that never happened. But the thing I think that was more of a breakthrough was just accepting that he was just going to paint differently. I mean, my uncle Dennis Rice, who features in the film, who's a friend of his I mentioned earlier, over that first coffee when I first met James, was saying, if you do continue painting, the painting will have a very different feel to it. I really think you could do some beautiful work. It would be different to the work that you'd done before. And when James was losing his eyesight, I always felt that when he was trying to technically achieve what he had achieved when he had full vision, that was less successful. It was when he almost let the paint speak for itself, then it was very, very successful. And in fact, in the film, in the last scene, really, he's at the Scottish Gallery in Edinburgh for his 25th exhibition, which turned out to be his last. And there's a painting there called Dark Landscape, which was painted over his last year of life. And it has an awful lot of depth to it. It also captures some of that anxiety and that upset that he was obviously going through at the time. I thought that when he was back and he was painting freely, even with that limited vision, he was able to bring to it something really quite extraordinary.
Now in northwest Greenland, almost 79 degrees latitude. How long has it took you to do that so far?
Well, I've been working since 10 o'clock, about 3 hours 20 minutes so far.
Oh, beautiful.
The movie Eye of the Storm benefits from archive footage found at the BBC.
That was really beautiful footage to find. It's always a bit like a treasure trove when you discover old footage like that. James had presented a programme for the BBC back in the 60s called Scope. It was like an arts show. He's painting on the beach at St. Cyrus Beach in Aberdeenshire, which is a beautiful, beautiful beach just up the road from where I'm talking to you from. And he painted there these stunning landscapes. And he was talking there, reflecting on the fact that he was contemplating death in his work. His journey as a landscape painter was very personal. It was very much exploratory of his own feelings and what was going through his mind at the time, it seems to me. Certainly that's what he says in that early footage. He says, I'm not doing this for anybody else. This is for me. This is my argument with myself as I sit here in the dunes and paint these landscapes.
And the moments of his life that weren't captured on film, he's described to you, and they're very beautifully animated in the film.
James had talked to me over one of these coffees we had in between doing a little bit of filming early on about his trips to the Arctic. He'd made several trips and he had the chance of going there because he'd met a philanthropist essentially at one of his exhibitions in Edinburgh who suggested that he go to the Arctic and paint. So he took up that offer. He made several trips and there he painted some of the last untouched landscapes by man. He took his canvases and his boards out from Montrose. They were shipped over to the Arctic, and he painted in these sub-zero conditions.
At least your paint is not freezing today, Jim.
No, it's perfect today.
The Arctic is melting, and the landscape Jim has painted here probably does not exist in this form right now.
And he described these stories to me, and I was thinking all the time while he was talking to me about how we might illustrate that in the film, because although he is very compelling when you're just sat down and listening to his stories, there is, of course, something cinematic about being able to bring those tales to life, particularly one he was telling me about his encounter with a polar bear.
Tom, out with his gun, found huge paw prints on the shore. So you have to take care. And then a few days later, some soldiers from Denmark appeared and said, you've got to be careful. There is a polar bear. You must keep well clear. And if he does surprise you, and then we got given a list of instructions. We were somewhat taken aback by this. And sure enough, when I was out painting, we saw the bear. The bear came through a gap in a little glacier. We were pretty concerned about him.
Originally, I'd thought of maybe going to the Arctic. At that stage, though, I realised that to get to the Arctic, as James had done, would be incredibly expensive. I mean, way over the budget that we had managed to get to illustrate that part of the film. But I then thought about the idea of animation and looked at various animators. It's quite difficult to find the right person. But Katrina Black, when she described how much she liked James Morrison's paintings and how she was very excited at the idea of using those as a template for her illustrations for, at that stage, the Arctic part of his adventures. I think it works really beautifully. James, unfortunately, never got to see it, but we have had done for the film audio descriptive version, and those scenes are described very nicely and magically too. So I think, you know, even though James was losing his eyesight and would probably not been able to see properly the animation anyway, the way it's described in the film and the audio descriptive version is really helpful. And I think he would have been very enthusiastic about it. He was certainly enthusiastic about the idea, about having a contemporary artist interpret his work in a different way and to bring her magic to it in the way that she has.
I went not knowing anything at all about what I was in for.
A towering iceberg viewed through a deep crevasse. A slab of ice breaks off and crashes into the dark water. Text on screen. In 1990, James Morrison took the first of four trips to Greenland and to Baffin Island in the high Arctic. Here, he painted one of the last untouched landscapes on Earth. At the McManus Art Gallery and Museum in Dundee, preparations for the exhibition, Among the Polar Ice, are underway. Katrina Black is researching these paintings to animate Morrison's Arctic journey. Katrina enters the gallery and approaches a large work which depicts a broad Arctic shelf beneath a dark blanket of cloud.
You can tell immediately that this one's a final studio painting, and these three have been done in the Arctic itself. The fact that you can see the individual brush strokes here.
An animated polar bear strolls by.
I'm trying to store up all of this in my head so that I can really think the way that he does.
With thanks to Screen Language for that audio described clip. We'll play the audio described trailer in a moment. But for now, back to Guy Peplow at the Scottish Gallery. And I asked him, considering he had 25 solo exhibitions there, if James Morrison was always a popular artist.
I think you can certainly say that. And he was, he taught within art education. He was a senior lecturer at Duncan & Jordan in Dundee. And in fact, when I first came to the gallery in the early 1980s, it was a time when he was very keen to stop teaching in order to devote himself full-time to his own practice. And the success he had with the Scottish Gallery enabled him to do that. And in a sense, he never looked back. Although he enjoyed the collegiate nature of teaching and enjoyed some of the interactions with students, and I think he probably did miss that in a way. But for a painter, the most important thing is to be able to paint. And I suppose the success that he had in the 80s and 90s allowed him to work every day and travel. And he started opening up new subjects. He's so much associated with Anthony Baxter, comes from Montrose and is particularly interested in these men's paintings. But my goodness, the West Coast became just as important for him for the last 20, 30 years of his life. He traveled to the Arctic, we know that, in the early 90s, produced some extraordinary work, which for me, in a strange way, presages in its powerful tonal contrast some of his late paintings affected by his eyesight. He worked in the Alps, he worked in Botswana and the Canadian Rockies as well. So he had an amazing time as a landscape painter, finding new subject and new stimulation as well.
One of the people James Morrison taught while at Dundee is blind artist Fiona Powell.
Well, in 1977, I left school and applied for art college. I got a letter from Dundee in September saying to come for an interview. So my parents took me up on that day. We were greeted by Jimmy Morrison. We were taken in for interview by James Morrison and Alberto Morocco and I think two others. and checked us straight away on looking through our portfolios as well. One thing about this day was it was the first day of term and the whole college was teeming with students. We had to go and get enrolled and get our student cards. That was all very exciting. And that was my first encounter with James Morrison. He was so nice, so lovely. It turned out that he was our first year coordinator and therefore looked after us all anyway. And my parents made very sure that he knew about my hard of hearing difficulties. And I found out that he went around all my lecturers and told them as well, so that they all made sure that I had to sit in the front row of each class and made sure I heard everything and knew what was going on. So that was just brilliant, very kind of him. He taught me painting and he taught us the basis of oil painting. So all I learnt about oil painting is due to him. He taught us to put together our own canvases. So I enjoyed this class very much. My sight was okay at that point, to a degree. I knew I couldn't see very well in the dark. It was during my time at college, I think maybe in my third year, that I found out that I had tunnel vision and that I would eventually go blind. I found this out from my optician. We happened to say to him, it was very odd that on the family holiday, we were playing ball in the cow's field at evening time when it was getting a little bit dark. And the ball was a great big round thing and I kept missing it. And my dad said, that's wrong. That's something very wrong there. Very odd. Please do mention this to the optician when you go. So I did. And the optician had long, hard look in each eye and then told us about this. It was more my mum that cried than me. I just thought, well, my sight is still the same as it was yesterday or whatever. I think I didn't quite take it in how bad it would get. I am still painting. I go to Hillside Art Group at RNIB in Edinburgh and I get fantastic help there from the volunteers and the tutor. They encourage me to keep going, actually, and work out ways that I can carry on. I did try magnifiers, but I'm past that now. They don't help anymore. We had such a thing as a light box, and that was quite good. You could put your picture on top and the light shone up and showed up the lines. I stopped using oil painting, to be honest, and went on to using acrylic paint because I find that easier in the circumstances, having to work either at home or at RNIB. Working with oils can be a little bit haphazard because you're using terps and linseed oil together with the paint. And these two items mixed together can be a little bit like a bomb waiting to go off. So a bit dangerous. And also trying to dispose safely of those as well isn't so easy at home. When you lost your sight, you don't know which one is which as per colour. So you do have to get somebody to tell you which is which. I would get my colours put out in the same order every time, so I would know where each colour was. And I would count along each compartment to find the colour I wanted and then use it from there.
And your whole family are artists?
Golly, they are. Why can't anybody do anything different? I wanted my son to be a plumber and my daughter to be an electrician. And what do they do? But he goes on to be an artist and she is a costume designer. No one takes my advice. My parents also, they were artists. Both of them went to Edinburgh Art College and Dad did sculpture and Mum did running painting. Dad asked Mum if he could model her head and he did a lovely sculptured head of her. And it was that time they discovered that they liked each other very much.
And your husband Mark worked with James Morrison.
Mark met Jimmy Morrison some years ago when he was working at the Scottish Gallery. He worked there part-time, but also he showed his own exhibitions of his work. And Jimmy Morrison must have seen his work. And through that, he asked Mark to make a necklace for his late wife. It was one of these occasions when Jimmy Morrison was visiting the gallery, Mark happened to be there too. And Mark told him about me losing my sight. And Jimmy was very sorry to hear that and was very complimentary about my work that he had seen at college, which encouraged me very much to think, okay, it must be worthwhile for me to carry on.
Thanks to blind artist Fiona Powell. Back now to filmmaker Anthony Baxter. In the past, we've seen you arguing with Trump, being arrested and trying to deal with the authorities in Flint. This must have felt a bit more relaxed.
Yes, it was. I mean, there is something that I do like about holding people in a power to account, and particularly when great injustices are done, be it here in Aberdeenshire when Trump built his golf resort, and in Flint in Michigan, where I made a film over 5 years about the water disaster there and the atrocity and the fallout for the local community. And trying to get to the truth is a really kind of important thing for me. It's part, I think, of my journalistic background. But there was something very nice, I must say, about putting that to one side and spending time concentrating on my other love, really, which is the visual side of cinema and filmmaking and not having to hold people to account. And particularly over the course of this last year, which has been so trying for everybody, doing a film which is really about the landscape and the beauty of this area, it does allow you to concentrate on just enjoying that. I mean, one of the things I think about James's painting is that he allows you to see the landscape in a very different way. You can enjoy the texture and the tone and the feel of the sky more so after seeing one of James's paintings. But it's also, for those people who don't have eyesight, I think it's also something that's just the idea of being outside and hearing the sounds that make up James's paintings too. And that is also something we've tried to bring out in the film very much through the music that we've chosen and also just the sounds of nature around, because they all build up to James's work, because he's capturing the whole atmosphere, because he never painted from photographs and he never included people in his paintings. It's always outdoors until more recently, of course, when he couldn't, on doctor's orders, go outside. He was always outside absorbing nature and absorbing everything that was around him.
Now that's deliberate. It's not a question of I've forgotten to put the people in. I don't want people in. And the people seem a kind of irrelevant to what the landscape is doing, what the landscape is about.
And so he helped me too to have a bit of a break from that cut and thrust of holding people to account and the kind of work that I've done previously.
And much easier to get insurance for this film.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yes.
Just to clarify that for the listeners, your film, You've Been Trumped Too, was basically cancelled in America. Its release was cancelled because the quotes you were getting for liability insurance were astronomical because of Trump's legal team. And as we're talking about the bare bones of the film industry, how about distribution in the time of COVID? Has that been difficult? And as you said, BBC initially commissioned it, will it be shown on TV?
We did two versions of the film. There's a 58-minute version, which the BBC, BBC Scotland channel is showing in the spring. And then they are going to show the longer version at a later date as well. It's really nice, though, to get it out to art galleries and to cinemas that have been hit by COVID-19, that have video on demand platforms, and also just being able to think about getting the film out slightly differently. For example, the Scottish Gallery in Edinburgh, where James held 25 exhibitions, have set up a virtual room of James's paintings for people to enjoy. There is an audio descriptive version of that as well, so you can navigate to various points through the computer and find an audio description of his paintings. It's a challenge, obviously, with COVID too, and it's a loss not to be able to see the film in cinemas and hear it in that kind of setting where we thought very carefully about trying to make it work as well as we could. But it is still interesting to be able to get it out to more people, maybe people who are housebound who wouldn't have been able to get to the cinema, and also people around the world more easily through the various screenings that we've got planned, from the Barbican in London through to the DCA in Dundee and further north in Inverness, etc. So it's a different way of doing it, but it's a challenge and an interesting one too.
Now let's talk about the Scottish Gallery itself. How accessible is it to someone with sight loss?
Well, we're in a Georgian tenement in the new town of Edinburgh. And unfortunately, when you come, you can come through the door, and then you have a choice of a few stairs down and a few stairs up. But we do have strong rails, and the stair was upgraded significantly a number of years ago. So we do get partially sight and blind people visiting, but often with a guide that can be their kind of visual explainer of what they might be looking at. So they would certainly be welcome, there's no question about that, and that I think would have a good experience.
And how's it been during lockdown, moving to virtual exhibits?
We're a year now into it, aren't we, until the first lockdown, and everybody's had to get used to it. At the moment, obviously, we are closed. People can't even come and pick something up. But we have continued to rehang the gallery every month, and we now film our exhibitions with a very sophisticated digital service called Matterport. So you can actually have what we call virtual rooms and wander around the gallery from room to room and see the paintings hanging. And that has actually been a lifeline for us. It's allowed people to continue to be engaged with what we're doing, the artists to still have some sort of a living out of the work that we can sell. But my goodness, we are looking forward to getting back to the moment when we can open the doors and welcome people back in.
Huge thanks to Anthony Baxter and to Guy Peplow, and to Cosmic Cat Films. I'll give out contact details for both the Scottish Gallery and Montrose Pictures in a moment, but for now, thanks to Screen Language, here's the audio-described trailer for Eye of the Storm.
A Montrose Pictures, BBC Scotland and Creative Scotland film.
I've got somewhere in the studio a drawing of Mickey Mouse. That was when I started to draw. My whole life has been mixed up with the art, with painting.
What I experience, what I'm doing, is something which is for me. It's my argument with myself.
James Morrison, a passion for landscape.
Trees that were about to be ripped out of the land, and he was finding that quite upsetting, so he wanted to record it.
Glasgow Film Festival selection.
Look at the Morrison sky. God's imitating Jimmy Morrison.
Portrait of an extraordinary artist.
James Morrison's grasp of our world of sky, earth, light, shade, sea and tree are part of my inner landscape.
My paintings, right up until 6 months ago, were painted outside. I went not knowing anything at all about what I was in for.
A journey from Scotland to the Arctic.
The landing was terrible. I went onto the little top step. I was almost in tears. It was so beautiful.
Now in northwest Greenland, almost 79 degrees latitude. At least your paint is not freezing today, Jim.
No, it's perfect today.
The Arctic is melting, and the landscape Jim has painted here probably does not exist in this form right now.
You saw the bear. My sight is quite badly deteriorated. I can't paint outside now, and it's a terrible loss to me. The very thought of coming in here and not being able to pick up a brush really terrifies me. I'm now being registered as partially sighted.
Now he must paint one final landscape.
It may seem to be a very minor thing, what I'm proposing and doing. But it's not so minor for me.
From the award-winning director, Anthony Baxter, Eye of the Storm.
For more information on seeing Eye of the Storm, head to the Montrose Pictures website at
www.montrosepictures.co.uk.
Or you can follow Anthony on Twitter, he's at AntBaxter. And for more information about the Scottish Gallery,
you just need to key in the Scottish Gallery to your keypad and we'll pop up at the top of the list. And then hopefully if the website's working properly, you can navigate wherever you want to go, and that will certainly bring you to these virtual rooms.
Thanks once again to Anthony Baxter, Guy Peplow, Fiona Powell, Cosmic Cat Films and Screen Language.